These statues have to come down.
It's always been a pandemic of the unvaccinated. The problem now is it's a pandemic of the willfully unvaccinated.
Falling birth rates are good. They're good for our planet. They're good for our societies.
We're not responsible for the escalation with Russia. We're not the ones who invaded Ukraine.
I don't think it's fair to portray people of color as victims.
It is a very dangerous time in American politics.
Hello and welcome to this, the latest in our installment of Monk Dialogues. These are long-form conversations with some of the world's sharpest minds and brightest thinkers. On this edition of the Monk Dialogues, we're going to go deep into the science, the medicine of the latest round of COVID-19 bivariant vaccines, so-called boosters. This we know. Health Canada, the FDA, and the CDC have all approved these boosters for anyone over the age of 12. And these shots are different from previous COVID vaccinations. They target multiple strains of the novel coronavirus, most notably the lineages of the virus that have come out of Omicron. And while these vaccines are currently being widely distributed around the world, here in Canada, the United States, and everywhere, some epidemiologists are advising caution about those interested in getting the latest round of jabs. One of those scientists and big thinkers is Dr. Paul Offit. He's the director of the Vaccine Education Center and an attending physician in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. For the purposes of our discussion today, he's also one of two members of the FDA, the Federal Food and Drug Administration Committee, who voted against asking companies like Moderna and Pfizer to make the latest round of Omicron-specific bivariant boosters. He joins us now to talk about why these boosters might not be necessary for everyone, who they could certainly be very helpful for, and why in some cases we may want to dig a little bit deeper about the risks versus the benefits of getting this latest round of shots. Paul, thank you for coming on the Monk Dialogues. Always a pleasure to connect with you. I want to begin our conversation by having you comment on the news that you made earlier this fall as a member of the Food and Drug Administration's kind of official impaneled committee that approves all vaccines and boosters in the United States. You broke with the majority of your fellow members at the FDA to not recommend booster shots for all Americans 12 and over. Give us your rationale for that decision. Why did you take a different view from your colleagues, and what was the thinking behind your dissent on the FDA committee?
Right, so on June 28th, the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee, on which I sit, was asked to consider whether or not we would approve the use of a bivalent vaccine as a booster dose moving forward. And I voted no. I was one of only two people that voted no. There were 19 yes votes. The reason I voted no was I didn't think there were any data that had been shown that made it clear that the bivalent vaccine, which in this case included both the original strain, the original recipe vaccine, the ancestral strain, and then the second strain, the data we were shown was BA1, which is the Omicron strain, the original Omicron. That's not the way this vaccine was going to launch. It was going to launch as the ancestral plus BA4, BA5. But in any case, even the data that we were shown clearly didn't make it clear that this was any better than just boosting with a monovalent vaccine. I would still argue we don't have any data that shows that that's true. And what the FDA decided to do was withdraw their emergency use authorization for the monovalent vaccine, thus only allowing for that bivalent vaccine booster. I wasn't saying that boosters weren't a value. I think boosters are a value. I was just saying that I don't see why that bivalent booster was any better than the monovalent boosters that we were getting.
Very clear. Thank you, Paul. Let's back up here a little bit. What exactly is a booster? I guess in my mind, when I hear the word booster, I think somehow that it's different from the vaccines that I've had to date, and not maybe different just in the composition of what's in it, but what it actually does. So explain to us, what is a booster, and is it in any way significantly different in its what it contains and what it does to us vis-a-vis the other inoculations that we've had to date for COVID-19?
Yes, and here's why. I think let me explain this by going back to the beginning. So in October, November of 2019, a strain of virus, a bat coronavirus, made its debut in the human population. It was called SARS-CoV-2. And a couple months later, in January of 2020, that virus was isolated and its gene was sequenced. So now you could make a vaccine. All the vaccines that are made, Pfizer's mRNA vaccine, Moderna's mRNA vaccine, Johnson & Johnson's vectored virus vaccine, are all designed to prevent that strain, the original strain, the Wuhan 1 strain. Now, that's not the strain that left China. The strain that left China was really the first variant. It didn't have a Greek letter designation. It was just called D614G. And that's the strain that swept across Asia, swept across Europe, swept across the United States, killed a couple hundred thousand people, only to be replaced by the Alpha strain because it was more contagious, only to be replaced by the Delta strain because it was more contagious. So that really was the first year. The first from December 2020, when a vaccine was available, the mRNA vaccines were available, to December 2021, those were the strains that circulated. So the question was, did the vaccine that we had, this Wuhan 1 vaccine, protect against these variant viruses? And the answer was yes. This was a study done by the CDC in December 2021, looking at the one-year experience with that vaccine, a two-dose vaccine. And what they found was, looking at 10,000 people in this study, that the vaccine continued to hold up to do what it was supposed to do, which is protect against severe disease, because that's the only reasonable goal for this vaccine. The only attainable goal for this vaccine is protect against severe disease, keep people out of the hospital, keep them out of the intensive care unit, keep them from dying. Two doses was enough to protect through that whole year. Then Omicron hit. That was the end of December 2021, and the Omicron subvariants, which then take us to the present day. Did the vaccines work as a two-dose vaccine then? And the answer was not as well for certain groups. So the CDC did studies showing that a third dose decreased your risk of hospitalization, and that later that a fourth dose, to a lesser extent, decreased your risk of hospitalization. But who benefited? Was it everybody? Or was it really just certain high-risk groups? And the answer was, according to the CDC data, only certain high-risk groups, specifically people who were immune-compromised, people who had the kind of high-risk medical conditions where even a mild illness could land them in the hospital, like long-term heart disease, kidney disease, lung disease, et cetera. And then the third group were people who were elderly, or as Dr. Walensky, our CDC director, says, thank goodness, the elderly, meaning people over 75. Which is good because that lets me out. So then, just within the last few days, there was another study done in the United Kingdom, which included the United Kingdom, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, looking at and this was like a 30 million person study trying to answer the question, who benefited from booster doses? Booster meaning boost the immune response that you got after those first two doses. Who benefited in terms of protecting against severe disease? And the answer was exactly the same. People who were immune compromised, people who had high-risk medical conditions, and here, elderly was defined not as people over 75, but people over 80. But again, we're talking about older people. So when the CDC on September 1st, the United States CDC on September 1st, said, we recommend a booster dose, a third dose, for everyone over 12 years of age, I just don't think that the data support that. I think a more targeted approach makes sense.
Let's back up here a little bit and just try to understand a few of the insights you shared with us. The first, I guess, that maybe is surprising to some people is you're indicating that the current science does not seem to indicate that a booster shot today based on the original wild strains versus a booster based on the new variants has much difference in terms of efficacy or outcome. Is that correct? And if so, what does that say about either the boosters themselves or what they're doing to our bodies to, in a sense, elicit protection?
Right. I think the best way to understand why is to look at the individual components of the immune response that are associated with protection. If you're trying to protect against mild illness or asymptomatic infection, you need a high level of neutralizing antibodies present at the time of infection, at the time of exposure to the virus. What happened with Omicron and the Omicron subvariants is those variants were immune evasive for protection against mild illness. Even if you've been vaccinated, even if you've been naturally infected, or both, you could still get a mild illness. But that's really not the critical part of the immune response in terms of protection against severe disease. Protection against severe disease is mediated by something called T cells. And there are two different groups of T cells. There's the so-called T helper cells, which help B cells make antibodies. And then there's a critical kind of cell, which gets scant attention, unfortunately, called cytotoxic T cells. Cyto, cell, toxic, harmful. So these are cells that kill virus-infected cells. Those are the cells that are probably most important in preventing against severe disease. Now, the good news, if there's any good news to be had from this pandemic, is that the part of the virus that's recognized by these T cells are much more conserved. So whereas, for example, where antibodies are recognizing regions on the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein that drift, which can be dramatically different from the Wuhan 1 strain to, say, the BA4, BA5 strain, that's not true for T cell recognition. There's about 80% conservation for T cell recognition between the original Wuhan 1 strain and now BA4, BA5, and that's why people are still protected against severe disease who are otherwise healthy and young, because they're recognizing that part of the virus that's conserved across all of these strains. That's why it's very hard to show a difference, actually, in terms of protection against severe disease if you're going to try and look just at these variants, because everything works.
That's super helpful. Very clear. I'm learning something here, so thank you. Is there a reason, therefore, Paul, potentially to be optimistic that we're seeing something happen here which could suggest that the future of this pandemic won't be as worse as the past, in that if that T cell response has been elicited through the initial vaccinations that we received, maybe we've received one or two boosters, many of us, myself included, obviously have had COVID recently. Does that mean, Paul, that potentially, we can now be a half glass full when we look at this pandemic and its future trajectory and course?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there is every reason for optimism. If you, when this virus rolled into this country in, say, January, February of 2020, what didn't we have? We didn't have monoclonal antibodies. We didn't have antivirals. We didn't have vaccines. And we had a completely naive population. We were immunologically a blank slate for that virus. And so you'd have, as we moved towards, say, fall and winter, you'd have 3,000 deaths a day, 3,500 deaths a day, 4,000 deaths a day. Then we developed vaccines by the end of December, and the virus continued to sweep through the population. So now, as distinct from early 2020, when we had 0% population immunity, now we probably have 95% population immunity, people who've been vaccinated or naturally infected or both. And natural infection does prevent severe disease. So it's a much, much different story right now. I think the question that's going to need to be answered going forward is going to be have to be answered by two groups. One is the CDC. CDC epidemiologists in our country and then the equivalent in other countries. And two are academic immunologists. And here's the question they need to answer. Take somebody like me. I had 3 doses of vaccine. My first dose was in December of 2020, right when the vaccine came out. My second dose was in January of 2021. And my third dose was in November of 2021. And then 6 months later, in May of this year, I had an infection. I had a natural infection. So I've had 3 doses and a natural infection. I suspect I have high titers of T cells, high frequencies of T cells in my body. And I think I'm protected, I suspect for a fairly long time, against severe disease. I'm not going to be protected against mild disease because my neutralizing antibodies will fade over 6 months. That has to happen, and that's what did happen. I mean, I got my third dose, and then 6 months later, I had a mild natural infection, a 2-day natural infection. There's no avoiding that. I think that moving forward, we are going to have to get used to the fact that mild infection and virus circulation is going to be part of this virus, even if the whole world were vaccinated, and even if the virus never mutated. We're going to have to get used to that. What we shouldn't have to get used to is having severe disease. And so the question is, for someone like me, how long am I protected for? Or for a healthy person, less than 65 years of age, who's received two doses or three doses of the vaccine, for how long are they protected? And so the CDC can answer that question, and the academic immunologist can look to see, well, you know, what kind of T cell responses are hanging out over time. And then we'll know really who does benefit from a booster dose over time.
Okay, you're no slouch as a vaccinologist with some pretty impressive scientific accomplishments of your own. So I'm not going to hold you here to anything, but what do your instincts tell you? You know, looking at the course of the data and what we're seeing out there, do you think that protection will be long lasting?
I think protection against severe disease will likely be long lasting for healthy young people. I think what happens when you get older or you're immune compromised, especially, is that you aren't very good at making T cell responses. I think for people who are younger and but have comorbidities, like say severe lung disease or severe heart disease, when they get even a mild infection, that could land them in the hospital. So it's sort of two separate groups in that sense. But I think that my sense is that protection probably will be long lasting. I think what I imagine happening over time is that you're going to see this virus continue to circulate, continue to cause mild disease, and continue to cause severe and occasionally fatal disease in some. And so I think our challenge moving forward is protect those vulnerable groups. And remember, every year in the United States, 3.5 to 4 million children are born who are completely susceptible to this virus.
Now, Paul, we're hearing a lot about new variants. It seems almost a week doesn't go by where there's a report. Sometimes they seem a bit sensationalized in the media about a new variant that seems to show incredible capacity to break through in terms of the vaccines that have been administered, but also the natural immunity that people have been acquired, the so-called reinfection. Are you concerned about these new variants? Are you concerned about the perceived risk? It certainly is discussed a lot of a variant that suddenly emerges that is not only highly transmissible, but has unfortunately increased kind of lethality. I know these are kind of known unknowns, so we're speculating here, but I just want to get, again, what your kind of instincts tell you, what you feel is happening out there in terms of your conversations with colleagues and what you're just seeing in the science.
Right. What this virus has done, which I think surprises people, because I don't think people thought coronaviruses could do this. I think people always understood influenza viruses could do this, but I don't think people thought coronaviruses could drift in the manner that these viruses are drifting. The good news is the drift still has been in terms of protection against mild illness, because it's basically what it's evading. The immune evasiveness of these strains has been against in terms of neutralizing antibodies. So the neutralizing antibodies you've gotten from being vaccinated or naturally infected or both don't work as well to protect you against mild infection with these viruses. But T cells still do. So what I would worry about is should a strain arise, and we need to look. We need to have the kind of international surveillance systems that inform us of this, that a strain should arise that is completely resistant to protection against even severe disease. Then we're starting all over again. We're not there. We may never be there. That might never happen. And when people sort of talk about, for example, a universal or a pan-Sarbecca virus vaccine or a universal vaccine, you could argue as long as T-cell immunity holds up, we're still largely protected against these different strains. And I think that probably the worst communications error we made, and we've made many communication errors with this vaccine, was back in July of 2021 during an outbreak in Provincetown, Massachusetts, when sort of thousands of men got together, celebrate the July 4th holiday. 79% were vaccinated. Nonetheless, there were 346 men who, despite being vaccinated, got infected. Four were hospitalized. It's a hospitalization rate of 1.2%. That's great. That's a vaccine that's working well. The rest had mild or asymptomatic infection, which sadly were labeled breakthrough infections. The word breakthrough implies failure. That's not a failure. That was a moment to celebrate that vaccine. It really was. In fact, there was a Republican senator from South Carolina that when he got a mild upper respiratory tract infection associated with sinusitis, he said, quote, correctly, this would have been much worse if I hadn't been vaccinated. right. And that's what we should have trumpeted, how good this was, but we did the opposite of that. We used phrases like waning immunity and breakthrough infections, thus holding this vaccine to a standard it cannot possibly meet. These are short incubation period mucosal infections, like influenza, like rotavirus, like parainfluenza virus, like respiratory syncytial virus. You are never going to eliminate these viruses. This notion of COVID zero is fanciful. So you're going to have to get used to the fact that virus continues to spread, continues to cause mild disease, and just identify those groups who are at highest risk to prevent severe disease in them. That's the only reasonable goal here, and I just think we don't explain that well.
Hey, Monk Podcast listeners, I wanted to let you know about our other weekly audio program. It's called Friday Focus, and hey, guess what? It comes out each and every Friday. It's half an hour long, and it provides you with a masterclass on international events, all the big issues and ideas shaping our world. We've got that for you each and every Friday here at the Monk Debate. Simply access via our website, www.monkdebates.com. Click on Friday Focus in the top right navigation. You'll get all the details, or check out a sample of the program in the same podcast feed as the main Monk Debates podcast. I hope you'll join us for the next edition of the Friday Focus podcast. Now back to our program. Paul, a lot of people have a concern about long COVID, and there's a perception, maybe accurate or not, that, you know, even mild infections can lead to the symptoms associated with long COVID. So to what extent should we factor into our thinking about getting boosted and the benefits of, you know, our current level of immunity versus maybe a more vigilant stance of, as you say, artificially increasing our antibodies to keep them high, in a sense, all the time, to really reduce the actual risk of infection itself amongst all age groups, to, again, address this concern out there about, wow, I really don't want long COVID. That's something I'm going to go to a significant series of extents and lengths to avoid.
Great question. And that's probably the question I get asked most frequently. Here's what I would say. So the question is, does vaccination, including repeated booster vaccination, protect against long COVID? How many times do I need to be vaccinated to protect myself against long COVID? So there was one study in Italy that just got published. And long COVID is many things. I think it's hard to define. Its definition is variable, not only sort of in different parts of this country, but in different countries of the world. But here's the way the Italian study was done. What they looked at was, what was the incidence of long COVID in people who got COVID who had not been vaccinated? And the answer was around 42%. 42% of people who continue to experience symptoms more than 12 weeks after their COVID infection. If they'd gotten one dose of vaccine, that 42% number dropped to 30%. If they got two doses of vaccine and then got COVID, that 30% number dropped to 17%. If they got three doses of vaccine, that 17% number dropped to 16%. So there really wasn't any difference beyond that second dose. Now, whether that holds up in the United States or holds up under different definitions of COVID, we'll see. But that study did not make a case for booster dosing anywhere beyond the second dose.
What would you say, Paul, to someone listening to this thinking, well, you know, 16, 17%, that's still almost one in five. And those are just simply, you know, unacceptable risks to me. That their perception of that is that it's a significant health risk, and therefore, repeated and scheduled boostering every, what it would be, 90 days, if you really wanted to keep your antibodies high consistently, is the course of action that they want to take. Can they zero that risk out, in effect, through repeated boostering?
I don't think so. Unless you want to, maybe it's possible. If you boost yourself three times a year, keep your neutralizing antibodies high, decrease your chance of getting mild illness by doing that, That's possible. But I was taken by this Italian study because there was no difference between that second dose and that third dose, which is to say you were maximally protected against long COVID to the degree you're going to be protected after two doses. That there wasn't an advantage to a third dose, and I think one could assume there's probably not an advantage to a fourth dose. I think when you hear people in public health now talk about how you need to keep getting boosters to decrease your risk of long COVID, I'm perfectly willing to believe that, but it would be nice to see some data that support that, because right now the data don't support that.
Fascinating. So basically, if you're going for a fourth and a fifth and a sixth booster, probably you're plateauing there in terms of the efficacy of one to the next in terms of any additional protection against long COVID. Let's talk about younger age groups, because as you say, the FDA has come out, and here in Canada too, recommendations that, you know, children as young as 12 and up, you know, consider boosting with these bivariant versions. What is your view of the risk reward for younger people? There has been reporting, as you know, about effects, cardiac and otherwise, very small, but nonetheless still there amongst young populations who have been inoculated with the mRNA vaccines. Where do you come down on that kind of risk-reward calculation for younger groups and boosting children and young adults?
No, that's a really good question. And I would say if you had to ask me what's the question that upsets me the most, it's when people say, yeah, well, what's the downside? It's like there's always a downside. I think to any medicine or any therapeutic, in this case, any biological, there's always a potential downside. And so if you look at healthy young people, especially people less than, say 30 and who are male, clearly this vaccine does in some, and it's not a trivial percentage, it's roughly 1 in 45, will cause a transient, short-lived, self-resolving immune response against your own heart. It's true. I mean, there was a study just done in Thailand looking at 300 children between 13 and 18 years of age. And then right before the second dose, they got blood and then obtained blood. This is after the second dose of Pfizer's vaccine, three doses, 3 days, 7 days, 14 days later, and saw that you had a spillage into your bloodstream of two heart enzymes, so-called troponin, creatine kinase, those levels came back down again. But there are studies also showing, and I think there's an article coming out in Science, which is going to go through these data, showing that even 4 months later, 6 months later, although those heart muscle enzymes have now decreased, you do still see when you do heart MRIs, you know, these magnetic resonance imaging studies, that you still see some evidence of an effect. And be humble here. Realize that there's always a spectrum of illness, and that there may be longer-term effects with regard to heart effects. And so if the benefits are clear, and certainly getting vaccinated, I think the benefit is clear, because remember, the virus itself can cause myocarditis. But once you get beyond that, and start talking about a third dose and a fourth dose, and the benefits aren't clear for healthy young people, then the risks, even if they're theoretically, even if they're apparently small now, are not trivial. And 1 in 45 is not trivial. I think what we initially, when our committee considered these vaccines, and we looked at, say, the myocarditis risk in, say, the 16 to 29-year-old, you know, it was around 1 in 6,700. But that was clinical myocarditis. There clearly is that was the tip of a bigger iceberg. There are also people who are sort of having this subclinical myocarditis, which may also have longer-term effects. So, again, benefits have to be clear before you ask people to accept risk.
Yeah, and maybe it's just important also to remind listeners, and maybe you can do that for us, that the actual relative risk of a younger person in terms of severe illness, hospitalization, and death, is it correct to assume that that is still very low? And is it right? Because often I know we make these imprecise calculations about the risk of influenza for different age groups versus COVID, but could you say amongst that younger, healthy population, in fact, maybe the risks of influenza in terms of severe illness and death are greater than that of COVID?
So about 1,000 children have died in the United States. A little more than 1,000 children have died since this virus came into the country in 2020. And when they die, only about a third of those children have comorbidities that would have put them at higher risk. So two-thirds of children, i.e. healthy young children, can be hospitalized and can die from this virus. when we see children, I guess the disease that scares me the most, because it occurs in that 5 to 13-year-old range, kind of peaks at 9 years of age, is this so-called multi-system inflammatory disease, where a month after basically recovering from a COVID infection, you make an immune response to your own heart, your own liver, your own lungs, your own kidneys. And those kids are sick, and sometimes they go to the ICU, and sometimes they die. I think as of right now, there have been about 9,000 such cases in this country, and there have been about 70 deaths or so. So can you be seriously hurt by COVID if you're a young person? Yes. Does a young person clearly benefit from getting a vaccine? Yes. Do the benefits of the vaccine in young people clearly outweigh the risks? Yes. I think what I'm talking about is beyond that, say, first two doses, or in the case of Pfizer's vaccine for the less than five-year-old, the first three doses, do the benefits of the booster dosing clearly outweigh the risk? And I'm saying I don't see that right now. And until the epidemiological studies make that clear, I just didn't agree with that recommendation that everybody over 12 in the United States should receive a booster dose, because I really do think we should focus just on those who are most likely to benefit in terms of protection against severe illness.
So yeah, let's talk about the public policy consequences of a recommendation for boosting at 12 and up. What do you see as the drawbacks of that recommendation, either in terms of people's perceptions about the vaccine? We know that uptake is very low at this point. Some people concerned about that. I don't know the extent to which you are concerned. I think it's less than 5% of Americans have opted at this point for the bivariant booster. So what's your sense of what comes out of the decision that you went against?
Well, it's interesting. The people who have decided to get it are interestingly those at highest risk. So in some ways, they know that. I think they've figured that out. Certainly, if you look at the uptake in booster dosing and then stratify it by age, meaning 75 to 85, 65 to 75, and go work your way down, you'll see that it's certainly the elderly, I would argue, who have largely chosen to get this additional dose. That's good. I think people who are immune compromised see this as benefiting them. And then people who have serious, say, heart or lung disease also see that. But the general population generally doesn't see that as being critical to them. I think at some level they're right.
Well, that's interesting. So what is your recommendation at this point if someone is trying to figure out, in a sense, what they should do? Let's just kind of summarize with different age groups. What would you recommend first for, you know, young people, let's say 25 and older, and then that age group, you know, often seems to be bracketed off 25 to 50 or 60. And then, you know, are there gradations of people's vigilance here that should kick in as we go higher up into different age groups? Or is it more important to think about your comorbidities and issues that you might have, you know, regardless of your age, that could affect your health?
I think number one is age. This virus, unlike flu, I mean, flu accounted for probably 10% of the deaths with flu occurred in nursing homes. It's 40%. For this virus. I mean, this virus is the angel of death for people who are elderly. And so that group should get vaccinated. Over 75 already get vaccinated. My mother is 93 years of age. She's now had her fourth dose. I think that's most important. See, the term immune compromised is a broad term. I mean, some people may be receiving a monoclonal antibody for the rheumatoid arthritis. Other people may be on immune suppressive therapy because they've just gotten a heart transplant. So I think, you know, there's different levels, different grades of immune compromise. I think some people are so immune compromised that they're not going to respond to the vaccine no matter how many doses they get. And for those people, you really need the kind of barrier protection, meaning, you know, masks, distancing, and just be really careful when you're out there. For others who are to a lesser extent immune compromised, there you clearly benefit from an additional dose to boost what is to some extent an immune response that's not great. And then I think people who really do have serious heart or lung conditions, I think, you know, where even a mild illness could hurt them, that sort of 3 to 6 months of protection they're going to get by getting a booster dose, say, around the winter time when this virus is more likely to circulate and more likely to cause a problem, because typically these are winter viruses. I think those people benefit. And then for the rest of us, for people, healthy young people who've gotten two doses or three doses or that plus or minus a natural infection, I really do think epidemiological studies need to answer those questions for us moving forward. I don't agree with the notion of a yearly vaccine for all, which is the flu model. I don't see that for this virus.
Just one gradation here, because I'm self-interested here. I'm 51 years of age. There's often 50 seems to be a cutoff, at least here in Canada, for our own health agency and its guidelines. It seems to stress the importance of getting a booster if you're over 50. Any sense of why we're choosing 50? Is that important? You maybe seem to be suggesting the number where you might want to stress or put more emphasis on the public communication around boosters could actually be older than that.
So in the U.S., when we first made these recommendations for older people, the number that was used was 65. That's the retirement age. It was a number people were used to define themselves as older. And then it dropped to 55. And the reason was largely lobbying by groups that felt like, this may be true for, say, a Caucasian middle-class or upper-middle-class community, that if you look at other groups, the kind of comorbidities like hypertension, obesity, is a phenomenon of the younger person. So let's cut it off at 55. I would say if you look at the data in terms of who is most likely to get severe disease if they didn't get a third dose, say, or didn't get a fourth dose, it's really the most recent studies by the CDC was 75, and the most recent studies, I'm talking the last 2 days, by out of sort of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, it was 80. So I think it's really what Dr. Walensky refers to as the elderly. So I think you're good, frankly, at 50, 51. I don't put you in that older category.
Fascinating. You must have thought a lot about what's happening in China, because we've, again, just seen the Party Congress, this major event that sets, in a sense, not only Chairman Xi's kind of unprecedented third term as the de facto supreme leader, but also reiterated a commitment to a COVID zero policy in China. Paul, what do you think they're trying to do there? Are they stuck in the sense that they don't have the vaccines that could, seemingly, you've painted a picture here of a series of steps that could very quickly lead to, widespread, not simply resistance against severe immunity and severe illness and death, but the challenge probably that they're thinking most about in China is the effects on their healthcare system and the extent to which they can protect that healthcare system in the face of a wave of illness. So do you have any clues as to what the thinking is there and maybe what advice you might have for them at this point?
So obviously China, it was easy for them to take the lead on developing a vaccine because the virus was there, it was isolated, it was sequenced. I mean, you had then the tools to be able to make any kind of vaccine, whether it was an mRNA vaccine or these Johnson & Johnson live, vectored virus vaccines. They chose an inactivated vaccine. If you had to ask me at the beginning of all this, which vaccine did I think would be best, that's the one I thought would be best. Take the virus, grow it up, inactivate it with the chemical, and then give that as the vaccine. That's the way that we make the polio vaccine. It's the way we make the hepatitis A vaccine. So it's a tried and true. And the advantage of that is it's all four proteins. So the virus, it's a relatively small virus. It's only composed of four proteins. But now you're making a response to all four proteins. There's an advantage to that. I think that there are certainly studies showing that in some ways you're better off being naturally infected, assuming you live, in terms of your protection than being vaccinated. Because when you're naturally infected, you're going to make an immune response to all four proteins. When you're vaccinated, you're making an immune response to one. I thought that would be the best vaccine. I was wrong. It wasn't nearly as good as people had hoped. So that was one. There's no reason China can't use vaccines that are not the inactivated vaccine. Even those were the companies that made it. They can buy that vaccine from the mRNA vaccines of Pfizer and Moderna. I'm sure Pfizer and Moderna would have no problem selling it to them. Or the J&J vaccine, or the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is another vectored virus vaccine. So that would be one. The notion of COVID zero is just nonsensical. It's not going to happen unless what you do is you say everybody has to stay home. So close schools, close businesses, test, isolate, quarantine, restrict travel. Then you can probably get there because we did get there. I mean, you know, when we, the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, every March picks flu strains for September because it's a 6-month production cycle. If you look at the data from like 2020, flu was gone, which tells you how much worse COVID would have been had we not done all the restrictive measures we did. But that's not practical, first of all. And assuming that people are going to be going to work and they are going to be going to school and they are going to be interacting with each other, even if they wear masks, you're still going to see this virus circulating. So I think COVID zero is just a marketing thing. It's not certainly anything that's ever possible. I think were I, you know, the president of China, and I don't see that happening anytime soon, I would say that, you know, I would move in with the mRNA vaccines because they're really effective, much more effective than one would have ever imagined when we were first talking about these vaccines.
So just finally, Paul, if we look at the future course of this pandemic, it sounds like generally you're optimistic that we're building up, immunity, obviously facilitated by the original vaccines, which were thankfully highly effective. And now we've layered that over with a significant amount of naturally acquired immunity, which it sounds like might be more protective than just the vaccines themselves. Should we, Paul, be, and again, maybe this is to misunderstand what the boosters are, should we be redeploying these boosters to other countries around the world that aren't as fortunate and affluent as we are? Like, would these boosters protect someone in Senegal to the same extent that my original inoculation began to protect me from severe illness and death?
Yes. I think, frankly, the most disappointing thing that's happened over the last few weeks was when the FDA withdrew its EUA for the use of just the monovalent booster dose. So those, what happens to those vaccines? I mean, they're excellent as a primary, you know, they're excellent. And so you would, you know, what's the immunization rate in this country? About 70%. What's the immunization rate in Africa? About 10%. I mean, does that matter? Yes, of course it matters to the world because the virus continues to reproduce itself, continues to create variants, which may become more and more resistant. I mean, you know, where did Omicron come from? It appeared to come from South Africa. So it affects all of us, and I just don't see that sort of international strategy that really should exist, because it is an international problem. You know, people get on planes and travel, and as long as that's true, look, if you don't believe that, just look at that polio case in Rockland County. Although this particular man who got paralyzed by that so-called circulating vaccine-derived type 2 strain, he didn't travel, but he went to he was at an event about a week and a half before he got paralyzed, where there were people who had come from Israel and other countries where these kind of viruses are circulating. What happens in the world affects all of us. So you're right.
And you know, we've seen another virus emerge that caused a lot of sensation in the media, which was monkeypox. It seems that threat has waned. I don't know if that is, in fact, a correct assessment of the state of monkeypox today. But what's happening here, Paul, I guess, to end on, like, are these viruses becoming somehow more prevalent? Do you think the frequency of them is increasing? We, you know, had Ebola in the not-so-distant memory, COVID, now monkeypox. Is something happening here? You know the argument. The argument is one about humanity pushing up against nature in a variety of different ways and stressing nature, and nature in turn has a response to our, you know, kind of invasion of its geographies, of its species. Are we right to think that we're in a cycle of history where we might see more and repeated viruses that possibly some of them could be future pandemics?
Right, so different reasons. I mean, if you look at SARS-CoV-2, that was a bat coronavirus that made its debut in Wuhan, presumably because of those markets, the Hunan market, where there was an intimate association, if you will, you know, among civets and raccoon dogs and pangolins and other intermediate species that allowed for that jump to occur. It's not the first time. I mean, SARS-1 was in 2002, MERS was in 2012. These were both pandemic potential coronaviruses because we live in close association with animals. That's true. I mean, rotavirus, you know, the vaccine I worked on is originally a mammalian virus. It affects virtually many mammalian, frankly, even avian species. Tuberculosis is, you know, is a certainly something that affects a variety of mammalian species, including cows. So, you know, so there's that. The polio story is really a different story. I mean, the polio story is that was self-created. I mean, Albert Sabin's oral polio vaccine could revert to essentially a paralytic type. And that's what it affected that man, in Rockland County. But that solution's easy. Vaccinate. I mean, he was unvaccinated. He lived in a highly unvaccinated community. And that's why I fear he's not going to be the last case we see in this country as people choose not to vaccinate themselves against polio. Because I think although we found, for example, that particular revertant strain, that vaccine revertant strain in wastewater in Rockland County or Orange County, we should look in every city in this country to see where it is, because I find it hard to believe that's the only place it is. Because remember, only one of every 2,000 people who's infected with that particular kind of vaccine virus that has reverted will become paralyzed. So he's the tip of a very big iceberg. And my question is, how big is that iceberg in the United States? But again, the solution's easy. Vaccinate. And we don't. So that's part of it. Fortunately, we live in a vaccine era, so the monkeypox can be certainly attenuated by giving this Jennios vaccine. And for someone like me, who's born well before 1972, where we stopped using the smallpox vaccine in this country, I'm probably protected against serious illness from monkeypox.
So just to end on vaccines themselves, you know, maybe it's important for people just to hear this message that, you know, I've heard a formulation that there are, in a sense, two great accomplishments of the modern age, one of which was the invention of the steam engine and the kind of unleashing, now for better or worse, of hydrocarbons to power an age of prosperity that's lasted over two centuries. And interestingly, I've heard people say number two, or competing with that in terms of one of the great accomplishments of the modern age, the modern era, is vaccines. Do you subscribe to that? And if so, why should we look at vaccines, and maybe why should we frankly make more of an effort just to understand how utterly transformative they have been of our way of life, of allowing us to have the society that we enjoy today? Because, you know, they've become demonized. There's a lot of, I think, fear and uncertainty often around them. And I think maybe people have lost sight to just how revolutionary they are in terms of the human condition.
Right. I think vaccines are a victim of their own success. I think when you, for example, see somebody like Jenny McCarthy go on an Oprah show and say, you know, that she'll take the measles every time because she feared that measles vaccine caused autism, which isn't true. But when she said that, you know, I'll take measles every time, it tells you that not only have we largely eliminated measles from this country, we've eliminated the memory of measles. Measles can make you sick, and measles can make you dead, as it did for 500 people, many of whom were children, before we had a measles vaccine in the early 1960s, and 50,000 people would be hospitalized every year with measles. Measles made you sick. And we don't realize that. I think, and you know, smallpox probably killed 500 million people in the world's history. And for those who survived it, many were left blind. It was a terrible disease, eliminated by vaccines. So vaccines, I think, are if not the single most powerful tool, say, as compared to, say, sanitation, purifying drinking water, it's certainly in the top three. And I do think we don't appreciate it, because I think we're living in an era now where people just declare their own truths, including scientific truths, like, you know, vaccines cause autism, or the mRNA vaccines change your DNA or whatever. And it's just, it's hard to watch, frankly.
Well, Paul, we thank you for being such a clear and concise communicator, for sharing your considerable kind of wisdom and expertise for us, and just all your public service. Prior to the pandemic, your innovation on important vaccines yourself, but also during the pandemic, you're certainly somebody here at the Monk Debates community that we've really valued talking to over the last 72 months or so. So thanks so much for coming on the Monk Dialogues today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for asking.
The Monk Debates are a project of the Aurea and Peter and Melanie Monk Charitable Foundations. Rudyard Griffiths and Ricky Gerwitz are the producers. Be sure to download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like us, feel free to give us a 5-star rating. Thank you again for listening.